Out loud, my parents didn't allow a Christmas tree in the house. I mean, you just can't be Jewish and believe that Jesus is the Son of God. It's the deal breaker. What about Jews for Jesus, you ask? To put it simply, I think they're nuts. It sounds like they are going to vote for the guy. For centuries, being a Jew was tough enough. What makes you think Jesus is going to help? He's one of the major reasons it was hard to be Jewish. It took years for the Christian community to get over the fact that we probably had him whacked. Mel Gibson still carries a grudge. For God's sake, it's the reason he had a drinking problem. Or, as he liked to put it, for the love of Christ, get me a margarita. I have to say that I was disappointed when the Catholic Church let the Jews off the hook. For centuries, they were absolutely sure that we were intimately involved in the crucifixion of Jesus. Even the Jews born hundreds of years after the deed was done. I have never felt the need to be macho, because I knew that my people had killed God's only begotten Son, and that was all I needed on my resume. Christ killer sure beats being called a kike. Of course, either expletive is usually followed by a good ass-kicking. But I felt it kind of gave me a leg up. I killed your savior, so bring it on. Talk about the ultimate fighting match. And why were Catholics so pissed at us? I mean, if someone didn't kill Jesus, there'd be no Christianity. Much like if Anna Nicole Smith didn't die, she wouldn't be famous. But I have to admit, I love the concept of Jesus. Once you have Judaism with all of its rules, then it makes sense that a guy like Jesus, who was himself a Jew, comes along and says, okay, God gave us the rules we are supposed to follow. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to follow them to the letter of the law. What then? You got the beginning of Christianity is what you got. Practice what you preach, if you will. Without Judaism, there is no Christianity. Much like on the earthly level of political stupidity, if there is no Bill Clinton, there is no George W. Bush. It takes a minor idiot to show us what a real idiot is. Then again, if everyone was Christ-like, there would be no need for politicians at all. It's logical to me that there was someone like Jesus. I just find it hard to believe he is the Son of God. God seems to me to be above the whole family thing. I mean, if God is all-seeing and all-knowing, then I think he'd have the common sense not to get involved with that kind of potential mess. When you've got the universe to deal with, who's got time for a kid? Besides, if he had a son, even though he could be a prick at times, I don't think he's going to let him get crucified. It sure is a lousy precedent to set. And the Lord said, always keep a large wooden cross handy around the house. Just in case any of your kids screw up, I'll crucify them. The Yashimura Code. During my first year at the Yale School of Drama, yes, I have a master's in fine arts from an Ivy League institution, there is a God, my friend and fellow playwriting student Jim Yashimura and I would have extended arguments about Catholicism and Judaism. As I remember them, I argued the fallacies I saw in Jim's Catholic religion, and he would defend them while going after the inconsistencies he found in Judaism. As you can see, we had a lot of time on our hands, and we needed to fill it with whatever we could grab onto, as the schooling was costing us both a small fortune, and we didn't want to think about that one for 1 second longer than we had to. How were we going to pay for this? We were going to be playwrights, for crying out loud. We might as well have majored in professional begging. Don't get me wrong. I really like Catholicism. It appeals to my sense of theater. You gotta love the pomp and the incense and the chanting and the costumes. And when the Mass was said in Latin, oh, I was absolutely enthralled. It was a hell of a lot better than Cats and most of the experimental theater I saw during that period. And they even served wine and hors d'oeuvres. As impressed as I was with the Mass, there are way too many downsides to Catholicism for me to convert anytime soon. I did once make the offer to convert for cash. The good people at Villanova University offered me an awful lot of money to perform for the student body there, with the stipulation that I did not make fun of the Catholic Church. I told them for an extra $10,000, I would start by accepting the infallibility of the Pope and anything else they wanted. They declined. For starters, the history of the Catholic Church is littered with more bullshit than I can put up with. Remember the indulgences, where a little money went to making sure that your sins were forgiven? Or how about the Crusades, where hordes of really pissed off Europeans trample the Holy Land to free it from the infidels? And then there's the Inquisition, which yanked the faithful back into the fold, kicking and screaming, and threw in a little maiming to make things interesting. Call me a pussy, but these things don't sit well with me. But Jim had no problem defending the church, and he had no problem with the idea of a pope. I, on the other hand, have always thought it made no sense. It wasn't logical to me that one guy would be chosen to be the guy to get all the communication from God. I don't trust the whole notion of it. The Pope is like God's cell phone to the rest of us. As holy as someone can be, and even I have to admit there have been some very holy men as popes, it's still tough for me to trust that their human brains and their prejudices don't get in the way of the messages from the big guy himself, especially since they're celibate. That's a lonely road I don't think anyone should go down. Trust me, I have been from time to time. Not by choice, mind you. And I believe it causes semen to back up, which isn't good for either the heart or the mind. And you don't want to be around when I haven't had sex in a while. It's ugly. Very ugly. Hey, I'm no walk in the park when I'm getting some. So you can only imagine. Think about it. The history of the papacy is littered with felonious popes. That would be a great name for a band, by the way. I would definitely buy a felonious pope CD. And it's not as if God comes down here every time and says on Larry King, "Hey, I've chosen the next pope." It's all political. The pope is selected by a vote among the College of Cardinals. It has to convene in the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican, and stick around until a majority of them vote for one of the guys in the room. That can take days, or weeks, or even months. If we picked a president that way, it would kill anyone trying to run. If that weren't enough, it's another all-boys club doing the voting. Can you believe that no women help make such a monumental decision? Has anyone in the Vatican looked at a clock in forever? Do they know what century this is? What are the nuns for? Decoration? Well, if so, I say you should look for some hotter uniforms. And by the way, the Catholic girls' school uniform is the most haunting of all fantasy wear I've come across in my lifetime. But I fear I share too much. I am definitely in favor of a pope God himself chooses. And while we're on the topic, I am not in favor of a president who thinks God chose him. So what did my friend Jim have to say to all of this? Why could he believe Catholic doctrine, even though he rarely, if ever, attended church? He had faith, he told me. Faith. And that was the key to all of my confusion. It's just a matter of faith. Faith that the Pope is celibate and is fine with it, and he's handing down dictums to be followed by people who aren't. And Jim's not alone. There's a trickle-down theory at work in the church. The celibate priest advises married couples, and the celibate nun advises teens on their sexuality. All I need is faith, Jimmy? Faith in what? Faith in the fact that I can suspend the human thought process in order to allow this kind of lunacy? No, Jim would say, it's the faith that brings sanity. And here's the best part. He would tell me the Pope is infallible. How do you know that, Jimmy? Faith, you ninny. I have to admit that faith is extremely powerful. When I looked at Jimmy, who's a smart guy, he seemed to accept the fact that the Pope knows what he's talking about, that the Church, despite its history of being greedy and violent and underhanded and a home for sexual predators, does want to help people be better. It makes you wonder if Jimmy is onto something. It's been working for a lot of people for a long, long time. I suppose it all depends on where you want to plug your life into. It's like choosing between AOL and Google. If you have the faith to believe in the absolute truth of the Catholic Church and its teachings, then there is no need for questions. You are set. You don't need to worry about a spiritual mortgage, wondering if you can make each payment. You've already bought the farm. You're set. If you believe the Pope is infallible, and all he says is true, then you are relieved of the responsibility to think about what he tells you that you should believe. It's a marvelous system that helps bypass logic. It's what makes all religions tick. My understanding of Judaism, for example, is that by practicing on a daily basis in prayer and thought and deed, you need not question a God who is making your way for you. And then there's the born-again Christian, whose faith can move mountains, perform daily miracles, and leaves the believers safe in the knowledge that everything happens for a really good reason. And you don't have to take that on faith. You can take it from me. I know about these things. Really. I prayed about it. The Cathejulic. I have never understood converting from Judaism to Catholicism, or for that matter, converting the other way. To begin with, both religions are squarely rooted in guilt, and while each faith deals with guilt very differently, neither does a good job of coping with it. So, why switch from one to the other? At least that's what I thought, until I read about the French Cardinal Jean-Marie Lustiger, who passed away in 2007. Born a Jew in Paris in 1926, Lustiger was sent by his parents to Orléans to live with a Catholic woman after Paris fell to the Nazis at the beginning of World War II. At the age of 13, ironically when he should have been bar mitzvah, Lustiger decided to convert to Catholicism. His parents, to say the least, weren't pleased. Apparently, they did not see the humor in it. And in a very sad twist, his mother died at Auschwitz. After taking a degree at the Sorbonne, Lustiger studied for the priesthood and was ordained in 1954. He rose through the ranks of the Catholic Church and eventually became Bishop of Orléans and later the Archbishop of Paris. At one point, he started to learn Hebrew and thought about emigrating to Israel. He wasn't so much marching to the beat of a different drummer as marching to the beat of a drummer with two separate drum kits. I was born Jewish, he once said, and so I remain, even if that is unacceptable to many. For me, the vocation of Israel is bringing light to the goyim, non-Jews. That is my hope, and I believe that Christianity is the means for achieving it. This may have been the ultimate Underground Railroad approach, but you have got to admire the balls on this guy. He proclaimed his Jewishness until his death, which didn't seem to bother the Catholics as much as it did the Jews, who never grasped Lustiger's ideas about knowing God. He was even considered as a possible successor to John Paul II. Could you imagine that? A converted Jew becomes Pope? Oh, the damage we could have done. As it turns out, we didn't need to get one of ours into the Vatican's top spot to screw things up. Lifelong Catholics have been managing to do it very well all on their own. The Rapture. If Jesus returns to earth, as many Christians believe that he will, how will we know it? In the midst of an information explosion, and with a multitude of idiots with nothing to say clogging our airwaves, how would he manage even to get a few minutes of our attention? God help him if he doesn't hire a really good publicist. Trust me, he's dead meat without a real shark in his corner. Considering the sea of hairless hoo-has and perfect ta-tas exposed by the drug-addled young starlets who are grabbing all of the headlines, Jesus certainly has his work cut out for him. He might even have to get the attention he is looking for by immediately going into rehab. He could say that returning was a real shock to his system. And so he started self-medicating on various painkillers and cheap red wine. Even if he does manage to grab a smidgen of our attention from online porn, eBay, YouTube, Facebook, MySpace, and the whole hysterical cyberspace of bloggers, who among us is going to take seriously someone who looks like any other Hollywood model actor wannabe? Then there's the outcry he'll have to deal with from the religious right and the televangelists. I can't see Jesus being really thrilled by the way they are representing him. They are certainly going to savage the sweet-faced boy trying to put his hand in their till. All I can say is he better have one hell of a website, and he'd better come armed with some bigger, better, and splashier miracles. Just walking on water isn't going to cut it anymore. What's more, he also is going to have to compete with the levels of insanity provided by reality TV. If he's unlucky enough to land in Vegas first, Penn and Teller will be there to expose how he pulled off the illusion. I don't care if you believe or don't believe. That would really suck for Jesus. I have to say, though, that this whole concept of the rapture, of Jesus ushering in his kingdom on earth, sure works well when it looks like the world is on the brink of some form of apocalypse. Not that on any given day it doesn't look that way, but I mean when it really gets cranked up. Like when Israel and Syria start staring each other down, or when the Cold War was in its heyday, and the Russians and the United States stood at the ready, poised with nukes akimbo. Or those moments just before we went after Saddam and his supposed weapons of mass destruction and the what-if fear that he'd just let them rip. It was at times like that I definitely took comfort in the rapture. It sure turns a big negative into one sweet positive. Golfing in the Kingdom. I've always had faith in a something, in a higher power. It's like the faith I have in the power of appliances to make my life better. It eases my mind. But there have been experiences in my life that have given me a sense of some sort of higher force, being, or whatever. Drugs, for example. I know, I can hear you. Don't tell me, Mr. Black, that you are going to advocate the use of drugs. No, Christ on a crutch, no. Why would I do that and spend the rest of my life having to explain myself? All I am saying is the drugs gave me, that's me, no one else, my first introduction to the possibilities of the unseen. Just because I couldn't see it didn't mean it wasn't there. I will repeat that. Just because I couldn't see it didn't mean it wasn't there. I swear, in a very convoluted way, it makes sense. Look. As much as I hate to say it, because our society so heavy-handedly judges a statement like this, but the fact of the matter is that LSD, mushrooms, mescaline, and psilocybin gave me a powerful sense that everything is interconnected. That's just me again. No one else. Even though I know now that I am connected to everything else. Everything. From the infinitesimal interior of the atom to the vastness of the universe and everything in between is all of one substance. I could feel it in the very fiber of my being. Drugs did this for you, you may ask? Drugs gave you a real sense of a higher power that somehow is at the center of the union of all we survey, leaving you with a sense of awe at its magnificence and splendor? Sorry, but they did. They also gave me a sense that there was a really fine line between sanity and insanity. So a little experimentation went a long way and was more than enough. I first had an inkling of the possibilities of these mind-expanding drugs in high school, when reports of Timothy Leary, a noted Harvard professor who was working with LSD, started to filter into the media. At the same time, in my chemistry class, My friend Don Smith had the idea to write for one of our assignments on the subject of LSD and similar drugs, like mescaline and mushrooms. Talk about a fun paper to write. My interest had been piqued, so when my pal Charlie Rock came back with some mescaline after a college break, I joyously scarfed it down with him. It was cavalier of me, I know, but I had a guide, and I had read Don Smith's paper, so I was ready for anything. And, except for the brief flashes of paranoia, thinking that I would be in this condition for the rest of my life, I had a ball. God, it was fun. Delusional? For sure. An escape from reality? You bet. And to quote my friend Steve Olson, who said about any great experience in the alphabet of fun, it was an A. Was it a real experience? Who knows? But I know it made me wonder what was real and what truly mattered, what was important and timeless. Like for Alice, the doors just kept opening, and the Cheshire Cat Charlie Rock kept grinning. The specifics of that day are not nearly as important as the fact that for the first time in my life, I felt a sense of transcendence. There were a few more trips taken on LSD, psilocybin, and mushrooms. They all reinforced the feelings of that first trip, and soon I felt there was nothing to be gained from their continued use. So I stopped. When I experimented with drugs, I didn't talk to God. I didn't feel like I was God. It just became obvious that there was something at work out there, and that maybe I shouldn't piss it off. It gave me a sense of peace I hadn't found in any part of the Bible or at any religious service I attended, or during any religious education I had. Until golf. I never thought that golf could be a spiritual experience, until I had one while playing a round. Golf, for me, is normally an afternoon filled with disappointment and self-hatred. It certainly is a game designed for people who don't hate themselves enough in their daily lives. So they play a game that gives them the opportunity to torture themselves. Relentlessly. I play it because it's a vacation from my brain. I spend the day filling it to the brim with inane thoughts such as, just relax and breathe through your ass. For sheer punishment, golf is a game that never disappoints. One afternoon, about 8 years ago, I went with my close friend Bill Fuller to play a round of golf at the first course I ever played as a kid. It's just a place to whack a ball around, and where a young kid could pretend he was playing the last 9 holes of the Masters and was going to lose the championship yet again on the last hole. As a child, even my fantasies were unfulfilling. It was across the street from where we lived, and on the grounds of what was then the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in White Oak, Maryland, where my father worked. It was a very simple and short 9-hole course, and really wasn't much to look at. For my bar mitzvah, my Uncle Julie had given me his old set of Wilson clubs, so I started playing the course 2 or 3 times a week. I had a few lessons at the local recreation center, and figured with that as a basis, I could teach myself the sport. I knew that many of the greats of golf were self-taught, but they were better teachers than I. I once asked my mother why, since she knew how much I loved to play the game, she never got me lessons. She said that they had gotten me piano lessons, and now I hated the piano. She didn't want me to hate golf, too. I played the course a few times a week because it was one of the few places outside of the bathroom where I could get away by myself. Since I never got any better, no matter how much I played, I guess I enjoyed the frustration. Yet somehow, the 9 holes that Bill and I played on that late summer afternoon were absolutely magical. We played at twilight. Trust me, I never noticed the light. And we were bathed in an absolutely lovely golden glow. It was sublime. We were the only people playing the course in what I can only call a blissful serenity. Strange, really, and we both took note of it, since one of us was usually bitching about our game. I have even been known to scream on a golf course. I know that must come as a real shock to you. Me, screaming out of frustration. Louis, surely you jest. On occasion, to underscore a particularly profanity-laced tirade, I have even thrown my clubs to let people know that my shitty play was their fault, not mine. Even stranger, we were accompanied by animals on nearly every hole. This was a course where I rarely remember seeing a squirrel. Now, forest creatures were everywhere. It was like something out of a Disney cartoon. Rabbits bounded around us. Mini deer, or creatures that looked like miniature deer, trailed at a safe distance. Birds of all sorts were hopping on the greens. We even saw an eagle. Or maybe it was a hawk. I am no Audubon. Chipmunks, and even a few normal-sized deer, kept a benevolent eye on us. I can only describe our round as delicious, a word I would never apply to the game. It seemed that what was happening as we made our way from hole to hole was more than a game. Something else was going on. I remember thinking quite clearly that it felt as if we were playing in heaven. The kind of heaven one might imagine as a child, or if one had the kind of naive view of heaven that some Christians seem to have, the one pictured in the children's books you'd find at a Christian bookstore. Only Jesus wasn't there as the golf pro. It was heaven if one were a totally obsessed golfer. I, who have never believed in heaven or hell, believe that Bill and I were in heaven that day on the golf course at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory. Within a year of that game, my friend Bill died of a heart attack. It was 1999, and he was only 52. He had just had a physical and gotten a clean bill of health. It was one of those events that shock you to your very core. We were supposed to leave the next day for a golf vacation with a few other friends. Whenever I think of Bill, I see him on the ninth green, getting ready to putt, and it doesn't matter if he sinks it, because we were at total peace in a realm beyond space and time. And Bill knows it, too. I see him on the green, a huge, warm smile on his face. 19th Newark Airport Breakdown. As I was writing this book, I found myself at the Newark Airport, getting ready to fly to Chapel Hill. It was the beginning of June, and newspapers were already screaming that it was going to be the worst summer to travel in recorded history. This followed the previous summer, which was then the worst summer on record to travel. If you know something is going to go wrong, and you know why something is going to go wrong, and you've already experienced the pain and trauma of it going wrong, wouldn't you make a profoundly concerted effort to avoid it happening again? Isn't that just common fucking sense? Why the hell do we stand with our mouths wide open in wonder saying, "Wow, it's going to happen again. I knew it was going to happen again. I just didn't believe I was that smart." Wouldn't you think, after you watched the shit hit the fan once, you would move the fan, so that when the shit flew again, as it always does, the fan won't get hit? What the fuck is going on? We have an organization in place that's supposed to deal with this travel problem. It's called the Federal Aviation Administration. Can someone explain to me what it is these people actually do? What do they do in the office all day? Make shitballs and throw them at the fan? They know, for starters, that they need more air traffic controllers. Those poor bastards, who, like teachers, are overworked and underpaid, are of vital importance, and are stressed like lab rats testing methadrin. So why wouldn't you hire more air traffic controllers? Is it so difficult a concept to grasp? Especially when the last person you want to be exhausted on the job is the one who's guiding big fucking planes around, filled to the tits with passengers and gasoline, and zipping around the skies at 400 miles per hour. terrorists couldn't concoct a better scenario for creating potential mayhem and death. They must be awestruck by the work of the FAA. If this weren't enough for the terrorists to admire, we are trying to fly too many planes at the same time. The system is overloaded. Is the FAA an extension of the torture staff at Guantanamo? Wouldn't you like to ensure that, apart from unforeseen problems, that a plane would leave and arrive on time and out of harm's way? Do those who work for the FAA ever get on a plane? Or do they take the bus? Do they ever have to sit there, strapped to a seat designed by someone with scoliosis, and listen to the captain tell them he'll be back in 15 minutes? To tell them he will be back in 15 minutes. To tell them that a scientific study had proven that 15 minutes was the longest amount of time you could tell someone they would have to wait for more information about their flight and that this could be repeated indefinitely, without the person gouging his ears until the blood poured from them, and that he would be back again in 15 minutes, as soon as he heard from the air traffic controller, who had told him it would be just 15 more minutes, really, truly. If it wasn't the pilot telling me that it would be 15 minutes, it was the airline's representative who was saying the same thing. And it helped to pass a nice chunk of the 14 hours it took to get from Newark to Chapel Hill. How do you turn an hour and a half journey into the equivalent of a flight to Bosnia? By overscheduling and underplanning. First, the plane I am supposed to be on arrives late from Seattle. So, when I finally get on the plane that was supposed to leave at 2 o'clock and is now supposed to leave at 4 o'clock, I believe all will be right with the world. Then, someone on the ground discovers a mechanical malfunction that can't be fixed. If you were in midair when you were told this, you'd be praying hard. But now, on the ground, you're just thinking, go for it. It's just a malfunction. How bad could it be? Dear God, just don't send me back into that airport terminal. So, at 5:15, every one of us on the plane gets off. We are told that at this point there is no plan B, which is always a comfort. Much like when someone has been killed by lightning, and his loved ones are told that God works in mysterious ways. No shit. At 6 o'clock, in order to stave off imminent rioting, someone from the airlines tells us we are to be given an $8 meal voucher, which would be good for a meal in, let's say, Bangladesh. Here at the Newark airport, where the area's already inflated prices are astronomical, $8 translates into a McDonald's meal that is guaranteed to give you a kind of gaseous nausea that at one time I was actually addicted to. It's the kind of sensation you'd get if you just ate a styrofoam cup. So why would you eat such a meal? Because after 5 hours in an airport, one begins to feel just a teensy bit suicidal. At 7 p.m., hope is sparked again when some new chirpy airline employee announces that a new plane, without that nasty mechanical problem, the aviation equivalent of the clap, will arrive at 9 o'clock. Apparently, the old plane would now be used as a decoy plane, so that when a plane wasn't available, it could be loaded with passengers who could sit there thinking that they would be leaving in 15 minutes. Our new departure time is 9:40, but we must now move to a new gate. Yes, why not? The new scenery will be invigorating, and it's right across from a kiosk that sells I Love New York paraphernalia. Goody, I'll stock up. On the way, I pass the airport chapel. What do people pray for in the airport? The plane arrives at 9:40, and we board by 10:40. And by 10:50, I am asleep. I awaken at 11:50. Oh, boy, I think. Almost there. I look out the window, and there is the ever-present line of planes. At that point, my brain began to eat itself, because it had run out of things to do, so it turned on itself, and my only thought wasn't a thought. It was the color red. And so, at 2:15 a.m., We landed at the Raleigh-Durham airport, my shirt soaked with my drool. I was a broken man. If I were a POW, and the enemy wanted to torture me for information vital to the security of our armed forces, all they would have to do is show me a picture of an airport, anywhere, and I'd fuck my country over like a pit bull in heat. How did the airline explain our late arrival? There was a computer glitch affecting all flights that day. You've got to be fucking kidding me. A computer glitch? How can major computer systems of any sort not have a backup system in place making glitches non-fucking existent? For crying out loud, you can make movies with a home PC that you can upload so that the entire population of India can watch them and no airline system can program a backup? Bullshit! It's like inventing fire and not keeping something lit in case the main fire goes out. If our ancestors were as dumb as we are, we wouldn't be here. No wonder we can't deal with the truly difficult problems like poverty, universal health care, or world peace. Why do I bring this up? Besides getting the taste of bile I'm choking on out of my mouth? Well, it's because I believe that if the Christians are correct, and there truly is a hell, then Satan presides over his flock at an exact replica of any airport in America. You spend an eternity wandering from gate to gate to gate until you finally get onto planes that never take off, carrying vouchers for food you cannot swallow without gagging, wearing a busted iPod, awash in a series of announcements that have absolutely no meaning, because any idiot would know not to do any of the things you're being told not to do. Be absolutely sure to pull your penis out before urination and aim at the white porcelain receptacle, not at the tile. You don't burn in hell. You sweat constantly, but ever so slightly, and you smell like a rancid piece of meat. And as a result, your genitals itch just enough to be painful when you scratch them, which is continually. You are too tired to be awake and too awake to be asleep. Your memory offers no comfort, for it is filled only with shadows and the voice of your mother saying, "Didn't I tell you?" An Airline Traveler's Prayer. O Heavenly Father, who in his wisdom created airplanes so that man could be like unto a retarded bird with a broken wing, please move things along and truly give unto us the miracle of teleportation. I don't know how much longer I can take this. Once I enter the doors of the airport, Heavenly Father, I fear that there will come a time when I will no longer be responsible for my own actions. I can no longer abide my spirit being extinguished in the name of airport security. I don't want to take off my shoes. My shoes hold nothing but my feet. I can no longer watch as they molest the elderly in the name of safety. In the name of Christ, your only begotten Son, my hair gel doesn't come in a container that is 3.4 ounces or less. I don't care that we are now in Code Orange. I have no orange to wear. I am losing my fucking mind in here. I want to tear off my clothes and run on all fours onto the tarmac and bark at the planes like a dog. Do you hear me, Heavenly Father? Can you feel my plight? I know it's not much in the scheme of things, but I am here 4 or 5 times a week, and I fear one of these days I will no longer be responsible for my own actions. It could happen on the plane, when they show on those tiny screens, which make me wonder why you ever gave us the gift of sight, a movie that could only have been made to play for cows in order to increase their production of milk. My own nipples fill to bursting as I watch it, filling with a black venom that I fear will spurt out onto my neighbor's bag of snack nuggets. Am I making myself clear to you? You who maintains order in the universe? Except in airport baggage claims, so I can always be certain that the wait for my luggage is actually longer than my flight time. And so, as I stand here waiting, wondering if I will ever see my hair gel again, I try to have pure thoughts. Thoughts that will lift me above the base animal urges I feel, like running up the conveyor belt to rip out the heart of an innocent baggage handler to assuage the burning in my skull. But higher thoughts don't come, O Lord. So I turn my anger on myself, and I find myself wanting to rip my eyes from their sockets, so I will no longer have to bear witness to the insanity I am watching. The conveyor belt is empty, O Lord. It is empty. It isn't even moving. Please move my conveyor belt, the one that rises up into the heavens and brings me closer to you. Amen. Ron, the Archangel. I will repeat, briefly, a story I've related elsewhere, as it was another spiritual encounter that has shaped the way I look at religion. I was at my younger brother Ron's bedside just after he passed away. I stared at his ashen, lifeless body and knew that he was gone, yet his spirit filled the room. I felt it all around me. It was so strong that I knew he was still there. In this moment of extreme loss, I was comforted by him, by his presence. I never expected that. I am not someone who believes in ghosts or angels, and yet, at that moment, I felt something completely inexplicable, and unlike anything I knew or believed up to that point in my life. Within a few months of Ron's death in July 1997, career doors that had been closed to me began to swing open. I have no doubt that my brother was the one who was helping to unlock them. How? I haven't a clue. What I do know is that my work as a comic began to be noticed. When I went to clubs on the road, there were now lines outside to see me. There were calls to my manager from television producers who had taken no interest in me before. I was asked to perform at the HBO Comedy Festival in Aspen. Within months, a call came out of the blue asking if I could put on a one-man show. It was produced off-Broadway and called Black Humor. No doubt some would say that I was finally reaping the rewards for my work, or that things were naturally falling into place, or that it was just the luck of the draw. I say it was my brother, working in mysterious ways. It's just like religion. You believe what you want to believe. E equals MC squared. When I sensed that my brother was still in the room after he died, it reinforced a belief I had. Or let's call it a feeling. A belief just sounds too heavy. When Ron passed, I felt with all of my being that while the body dies, we don't really go anywhere, because we're just this collection of energy. The religious would prefer to call it the soul or the spirit. But I call it energy. And the great thing about energy is that it doesn't go away, because it has nowhere to go. Maybe it doesn't have a driver's license. It doesn't die. It just becomes something else. Now, for all I know, it becomes a butcher block table. But also maybe it remains conscious. And wouldn't it be hell to be a conscious butcher block table? From what I gather, these are basic laws of physics. But I didn't take physics in college because it was a tough subject. And as far as the sciences went, I had the brain power of a butcher block table. It would have been nice if I'd studied it, so I could clear this all up for the reader and myself. At times, when I am truly nuts, I think that we are always here, that every moment you've existed remains in space. Every nanosecond of time remains. everything that has ever happened continues to happen from the beginning of time to the end of time simultaneously. It is a never-ending chain of events. It's why people think they can go back in time and into the future. A lot of science fiction tales are based on this idea. It's an idea that I think might be real. I can't explain it. I just feel it. But like I said, I'm crazy. Virtual reality. In the summer of 2007, I read an article by John Tierney in the New York Times. In it, he quoted Dr. Neil Bostrom, the head of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. This is what the good doctor had to say. My gut feeling, and it's nothing more than that, is that there's a 20% chance we're living in a computer simulation. A thought like that is enough to bring an end to my day. All of this world is just a computer simulation? I get shooting pains behind my eyes just thinking about the possibility. If you thought that, Mr. Big Shot Doctor, why would you tell anyone? So, I'm not the creation of a just and loving God, but of some angst-ridden 13-year-old kid who, instead of taking the edge off his life by masturbating, has come up with a virtual world that he loves to torment. But what if it's fucking true? Think of the implications. I have never had sex with anybody. I never appeared on The Daily Show or made any movies, and I never won a Grammy Award. My life would really suck. Or, as the case may be, it would virtually suck. On the upside, however, my ex-wife would never have existed. In the big picture, not a bad trade-off. So, why am I running around the country performing? Why am I killing myself writing this book? This makes existentialism look like the Playboy philosophy. To be perfectly honest, I'd rather believe in intelligent design than that we're all living in some kind of video game. It doesn't end there. John Tierney poses the nightmarish question. What if the designer of this simulation is a virtual being too? And what if he is living in a simulation operated by another virtual being? And what if it's ad infinitum? Jesus, it was thoughts like these that made me stop doing drugs. The truth shall make you free. As the heady, turbulent, confusing 60s wound down and lurched into the much more complacent 70s with its incessantly annoying disco beat, many of my generation turned their attention away from hedonistic indulgences and toward more spiritual pursuits. Somewhere among the drugs and the music and the growing paranoia of the times, or perhaps it was just the overwhelming sense of hopelessness, since we naively believed we would change the world and our legacy seemed to be long hair and bell bottoms, the next logical step seemed in the direction of religion. If you could change the outer world, the theory went, maybe you could change your inner one. When you think you're going to change the world, and ultimately you find out that it's just not going to be possible, when your president and Congress don't really give a shit, and you aren't going to participate in an armed revolution or start another food co-op, the search for an underlying and immutable force starts to make sense. Maybe that's why a marked resurgence of Christianity took place a few decades later. If you can't change this world for the better, then you'd better find peace for yourself in the next one. In much the same way that my generation had a voice in the issues of the day disproportionate to our size, so the Christian right has been enjoying an outsized influence during Bush the Younger's ruthless reign. Or at least thought they were, as much has been written about how the administration used them. In the end, we both took it in the ass. I doubt the Christian right would like to hear it put that way. Back in the 1960s, I had an experience that I would call spiritual. I'd been given a playwriting fellowship, so after I graduated from college, I stayed on in Chapel Hill for a year and began working on a play with a few of my fellow students. During that time, I began to read a book by Alan Watts called The Taboo Against Knowing Yourself. In many ways, it was a very simple, even simplistic view of how to live a more spiritual life. But simplistic or not, I took from it a major life lesson. Always tell the truth. As I said, it wasn't what you would call complicated reading, but I took the book's advice. For the first time in my life, I stumbled onto the concept of faith. Maybe I was just trying it on for size as a way to allay my fears over writing the play. I remember being decidedly nervous about whether it would be any good. Whatever the reason, it worked. I believed that all would be revealed, and it was. What exactly it was that was revealed, I have no earthly clue anymore. And quite frankly, who cares? But I do remember feeling okay about things at the time. I have never experienced anything like it before or since. Even now, as I stare at this half-empty page, I try to bring that naive faith back into my life. All will be revealed, my faith tells me. The page will be filled. But at my age, and with the knowledge of experience, my brain just laughs at me, as if to say, good fucking luck. But back in the 60s, things were very different. It was an extraordinary time. I never doubted that I would eventually fill those empty pages with the play that I needed to write. My brain had focused on telling a story, and my subconscious, supported by my faith, relaxed enough to listen. No matter where I turned at the time, I was given an answer. If it wasn't the answer itself, it was something that led me to the answer. The faith gave me a certainty that I have never known with my writing. I understand now when people talk about how God revealed a path to them. It is faith that initiates the revelation of the path. And in turn, faith can produce all sorts of miracles. It just seems to take a major miracle to find the faith and hold on to it. Especially in a world where there is so much information swirling around that you've got a perpetual howling in your ear. What's that, Faith? Is that you, Faith? I can hardly hear you. Hey, it's hard to keep the faith when it only speaks in a whisper. It wasn't just the play that was affected, and it turned out to be a hit, by the way, but my life was changed. If someone needed advice, I knew exactly what to tell them. And I had no fear of doing so, because I knew I was speaking the truth. How did I know? Because I spoke whatever was on my mind, without taking into account the feelings of the other person. I actually thought people would appreciate my brand of honesty. I'm not so sure that they did. One thing is for certain, however. Whatever I was doing made me feel high. It wasn't a stoned high, just a very clear-headed one. And then one day, it all went up in smoke. I will never forget it. We were performing the play in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was asked by a young professor from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte to join him and his wife for drinks at their home after the show. I accepted and showed up with Gail, an actress in the play I was hopelessly in love with. I was the playwright. She was the actress. Oh, the unrequited, cliched love of it all. The prof wanted to pick my brain. He was a professor of black studies at the university, and he and his wife were white. Apparently, the university administration had been unable to find any African Americans in North Carolina. It happens. Anyway, here he was, an upper-middle-class white man, teaching middle-class white students about a black underclass he could never truly understand since, well, he was white. Let's just say he had something of an internal conflict going on. I knew exactly what advice to give him. I was 22 years old and a recent college graduate. I knew it all. I told him that he had to find a way to reconcile his lifestyle with his beliefs. Was I brilliant or what? Of course, when pressed, I had to admit that I didn't know what he could do to bring about this reconciliation. And that's when it struck me. I'm only 22 and barely out of college. I know absolutely nothing. Who was I to pass judgment or hand out advice? Where were the adults giving me advice? But I couldn't tell this professor the truth. All I could tell him was what he wanted to hear, which was that he was on the right track. So I told him that. I told him what would make him feel good. It was at that precise moment in time that my faith evaporated, and from then on, I found it harder and harder to tell the truth. I have spent my life trying to get back to the way I lived then. As insane as I know this sounds, I felt I had been completely in tune with the universe. Now I feel totally out of step, slightly disconnected from everything and everyone. Age of Disenlightenment. It was the Beatles who played a large part in bringing to our shores religious figures from the East. The incredibly influential rockers had taken a trip to India in 1968, and had hooked up with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and his path to enlightenment called Transcendental Meditation. The group's trip was one long commercial for the Godhead. By the time the Maharishi hit stateside, people were lining up to see him. Imagine if the Beatles had embraced Islam the way Cat Stevens did. Who knows where we would be now? We might have avoided September 11th, or maybe we just would have attacked ourselves. So once the word of the successful tour of the Maharishi got back to India, the floodgates burst open. First, there were the Hare Krishnas, who inundated this country's streets and airports with tambourines, sandals, and outstretched hands. And let's face it, they had to love God if they were going to look like that. Saffron robes and bald heads with ponytails. They make the geek of today look GQ. Not to be outdone, we even started to grow our own gurus here. It was all about enlightenment. This worked well for the mindset that wanted the perks of religion without having to deal with God. Or if there was going to have to be a God, then at least you could see his embodiment here on earth. One of the first of these new snake charmers I had contact with was the Guru Maharaji. It was Gail who led me to him. Sitting at his feet was the last place I wanted to be. But unrequited love plays strange tricks on the brain, and as any man knows, it sure can do a number on the penis. Gail had written to me that she was in London and was now a follower of a 13-year-old guru. She had become a member of his dance company. 13 years old and the kid's a guru? You gotta be kidding me. At least that was my first thought. And then my second. And my third. My fourth thought was that the guy has gotta be a midget. For God's sake, that's the age I was bar mitzvahed. How does someone with acne lead anyone along a spiritual path? Oh, if I had only known this when I was bar mitzvahed. I would have become the world's only 13-year-old rabbi, moved to Los Angeles, started a congregation, and really got my career off to a speedy start. It was tough enough for me to stand in front of family and friends, reading from the Torah and Haftorah in Hebrew, and then translating the passage and explaining what it all meant to me. And this kid was in charge of his own religious group? Or a cult? But a cult of what? Clearasil? Doesn't a religious leader need a driver's license? Christ, by 13, I hadn't even figured out how to masturbate. I didn't know how to please myself, let alone worry about pleasing God. I was in a bit of a panic about Gail, so I called her in England. She seemed completely content, even serene. I threw out a few arguments about the idiocy of following a 13-year-old guru, but to no avail. Are you sure you haven't lost your mind? I asked. No, she said joyously. I have found it. Oh, sweet Jesus, I said to myself. Gale is one of the most sublime and wondrous creatures I have ever met on this planet. I would seek out her new bar mitzvah boy and see what he was up to, in the hope that I'd understand what my dear friend had gotten herself into. The first contact I made with the boy wonder was in Colorado, at a huge festival in his honor. Apparently, many of the folks saw the guru as the Lord of the universe. With a 13-year-old Lord, I thought, this must be a pretty young universe. I wasn't buying it. A 13-year-old Lord, awash in the changes brought on by puberty? Fuck.